So we come to this practice out of either some doubt or a combination of doubt and hope. And to live is to question and to doubt. And we begin our questioning with the assumption that there are some sorts of final answers to be found. And in a way that's true, and in a way it's a red herring. Because when we look at life more and more deeply, we find ourselves facing below every question and every answer we attempt to come up with, there's another question. And for myself, there was a period when I was practicing and doing my inner work in which I recognized that I couldn't seem to get it. I couldn't seem to get life. It was like it always kept dissolving. My understandings, my answers all kept dissolving in one after another. And unfortunately, I reached the conclusion, again, this is the trap of fabrication or making stories out of, I reached the conclusion there was something wrong with me because I didn't know. I couldn't come up with an answer. And then there was a moment of wonderfully liberating insight in which I realized that life is a fundamental mystery. And that the questions we ask of life are basically take us to the limits of both our questioning and our trust in our capacities and our ability to answer in the very limits of the mind, and leave us in the recognition of awe and mystery. And when we do that, it's this extraordinary sense of relief. It's like, oh, we've all been on this great search, trying to understand the nature of life and ourselves, and we are way beyond, and life is way beyond anything that can be understood or fitted into a little conceptual box. Now, I have spent my life building conceptual boxes. I love them. And they can be, the question is, how do we use them skillfully and how do we not? So, at a very deep level, one comes to a kind of trust that life is this extraordinary mystery, and somehow it is living us in ways that are far greater than our little egos can understand or conceive of. And this is spoken of in numerous ways, in numerous traditions. You know, the source of that living is called everything from Rigpa to God to the Tao. And as we let go into this, there's there's a deepening trust that comes with us, with it, because we go through a variety, as we continue to practice, we go through the highs and the lows, which you all know, and some of those high/lows are the actual growth points, the transitions, the real jumps, and those, the real growth steps, the real jumps, always seem to be leaps into the unknown. And the first couple of times you do it, it feels really scary, and it looks before you make the jump as though it's going to be a loss. And then when you get to the other side, as Lama Suri was talking about this morning, you find it's a gateless gate, and it's not a loss. All that one has to let go of is one's attachment to one's former way of being and its roles and identity. And he'd do that, that's all. And he'd do that a few times, and gradually the trust develops. So one gradually just feels a greater trust in the process, that our lives are being lived by something much, much larger than us. And it's there's a beautiful, and there comes a sense, particularly when we move into Dzogchen level teachings and non-duality, the recognition that it's all part of the path, or it's all part of the Tao. And if you remember the 10 ox herding pictures, those exquisite 10 pictures that portray the stages of spiritual progress, the ninth picture is titled Return to the Source? The eighth is called Return to the Source. And then there's a commentary, a classic commentary that goes with each of the pictures. And the commentary for the eighth ox herding picture is, return to the source, already an error this. An error. It's an error to think we've ever been separate, or that we could stray from the source. And so there's this growing appreciation that whatever experiences we're having seem like they're part of the program. And those experiences can be at times, as we all know, very weird. And put it mildly. And some of them are the kind of ego death rebirth that we've been talking about at various times. Others can be the weird efflorescence of hypnagogic-like experiences and so forth, which we're very tempted again to try to make meaning out of and understand, and is this okay? And the answer seems to be the mind. It's very useful to know that the mind... One of the great tragedies of life is that the vast majority of people live with a fundamental distrust of their own minds and live trying to escape from their own inner depths. And this is one of the great tragedies of life, that people fear what is within. And yet, as you know, more fully we open, the deeper we plumb, the more unusual experiences arise, and we find that the deeper we go, the more gifts and extraordinary capacities and dharmic attributes we find within us, until eventually we come to this this wonderful recognition that we started off cultivating particular qualities. We started off cultivating clarity and wisdom and compassion and love, and yet we begin to intuit that, oh my goodness, that's actually what I always already am. So we cultivate until we recognize. And the more we recognize, the more the trust increases, and the more we just appreciate the display, whether it's hypnagogic experiences or whatever arises. And we recognize that the classic teachings talk about the bardos, these major transition between states or realms, but actually we're in a continuous flux of bardos. That our state of consciousness, state of mind, is shifting moment by moment in a continuous flux. And that actually one can think of a moment by moment bardo. That there's an arising and passing away of states of mind or bardos, whatever terms you want to use. And that too has some sort of innate wisdom to it. And the more deeply we tap into ourselves, the more deeply we trust, the more deeply we recognize that the wonderful thing to know about the mind is that given appropriate conditions, and those conditions just happen to be exactly the ones that Dharma practice provides, the mind turns out not to be untrustworthy, but fully trustworthy. And it turns out to be self-healing, self-actualizing, self-transcending, and self-liberating. You know, the inner wisdom of the psyche is far more than our little egos. And it's a wonderful relief to trust more and more, to, you know, let the universe or Rigpa run the show rather than ourselves. And as we dive more and more deeply, we begin to intuit particularly in the Dzogchen practices, the Trekchen practices, and what we're doing here, we begin to find at the very heart of, or core of the mind, that the very mind essence, the very essence of awareness is beyond any of our experiences or concepts or any label. It is radically unqualifiable, that it has no qualities we can attribute to it. And yet, there is this awareness in each and every moment. And the samayas, that this is all pervasive, not a thing, etc., etc. We make that recognition, and whether you want to call it, whether you want to think of ourselves as expressions of that, or put it in a force field, these are metaphors. These are all concepts, and they are concepts about phenomena, and Buddha nature. Rigpa is not a phenomenon. And anything you say about it is inaccurate, including that. You can't, you know, this is the radical unqualifiable. This is Nagarjuna's four statements. It's not this, it's not that, etc., etc. And yet, we can experience this. And that is always already present for us, as long as we think there's an us to experience it, separate from that. And the reality is that, yes, we have this, we partake, you know, the words don't do it. We partake. We are expressions of the same Rigpa that Longchenpa was. And we seem to have a few more obscurations than Longchenpa, as far as I can see. So then, yes, if we can simply rest in Rigpa, then nothing else is required. And that's not the way it is for most of us. So, as Lama Surya keeps pointing out, we do the relative practices. We do them because they are the best ways of paring away the clouds, the filters, the veils, the illusions that seem to stand between us and Rigpa, or us and Buddha nature. And we do those practices to the extent they seem helpful. And one of the ongoing challenges for us is to intuit for ourselves what is most helpful. And we are forced at certain stages of our practice to recognize and this is a very deep insight, the groundlessness of our worldview, our belief system, our values, etc. The Bodhisattva has nowhere to stand, i.e. that all beliefs that usually we use to guide us, oh, the right thing to do in this situation is so-and-so, all those are at bottom, when we look deeply enough, they have no foundation. They are a creation, something we create, which can be potentially useful or can be a trap, depending on how we relate to them. But they are but the Bodhisattva has nowhere to stand. So what then are we left with for us to choose as to what is skillful and what is unskillful to do? Well, it's really interesting. If you look at the Buddha's life, I mean, he's one of the most remarkable human beings to ever hit the planet. Whether you have a archetypal, idealized version, or just a human view. This was a human being who lived 2,500 years ago. Now, isn't it interesting that one of the wisest people who's ever lived, when he's dying, would give as his final words, here's a guy who taught for, what was it, 50 years or something? And what's he say on his deathbed? Be a lamp unto yourselves. Be a lamp unto yourselves. Look to yourself for your guidance and your illumination. And so the question which we all face is, multiple times a day, what is the most skillful thing for me to do? Is one that requires us to recall that teaching and to recognize that, and here again, we come back to a developing trust, that at some level, we always already know what's seems most skillful in the moment. That doesn't mean we know how things are going to turn out. But we do have an intuitive sense at each moment of appropriateness. We have this inbuilt radar, which is an exquisitely sensitive Dharma guidance instrument. And our work is to do our practice, and one beautiful result of doing our practice is that the veils or obscurations over that inner guidance become thinner and thinner, and we become increasingly sensitive to it. And I'm sure you have noticed that there's a very interesting side effect of this, which sometimes doesn't feel so good, but actually, we all recognize is wonderful, and that is you go to do something which you could have got away with a couple of years ago, and there's just this inner and it's like you just can't do it. You feel that there's a kind of contraction, tension, constriction of mind. And it's like, it just doesn't feel good. And on the other hand, more and more, what we sense is appropriate feels, yes, feels good, feels aligned with our deeper being, and is increasingly feels like an expression of our deeper nature, our Buddha nature. It is an expression of which both feels right and feels somehow aligned with our deeper nature and with the situation of the moment. Doesn't mean we don't make mistakes. I used to think that enlightened people, awake people didn't screw up. Now I think the difference between awake people and ordinary people is that everyone screws up, wise people clean up. Yeah. So we will still screw up, we'll still both succumb to temptations, and there'll be obscurations hindering the awareness of our inner radar, and things will turn out very differently than we expected. And increasingly, we just trust that we'll do what's appropriate in the moment. So we do that, and we increasingly find that inner radar, that guidance, is pulling us towards a life that is increasingly oriented both to Dharma and, not that they're separate, and to life of service, to contribution, to sharing. That is, again, there's the recognition that the bodhisattvic aspiration, and one of the most beautiful recognitions of the path is this: we do the bodhisattva practices, we aspire to serve and to help and be an optimal instrument of service for all beings, and gradually we become to realize, oh, this isn't something I have to force or create. This is actually what I most deeply desire. And with that, there is this wonderful sense of relief and joy and even deeper trust in oneself and the process. And then our challenge becomes, well, how do we make ourselves ever more effective instruments of help and healing and service? And that, of course, is the challenge of upaya, or skillful means. And so the question, for example, I have these experiences, but then I can't communicate them. Well, yes, of course. Experiences arise, insights, wonderful revelations, but then we have to understand them, which takes time, and then beyond understanding, we have to find a way to express them, to communicate most skillfully and helpful. This is a very mature level of right speech. Right speech isn't just saying, telling the truth and not lying. That's foundational and fundamental. But beyond that are levels of things like, okay, how do I communicate most skillfully, most helpfully to this person with this issue at this moment? And that is going to be a lifelong challenge for each and every one of us. The eightfold path is not like, oh yeah, I get this one down. It's like right speech, for example. I mean, I'm still amazed how often I find myself, someone asks me something and something pops out of my mind and say, why? It's like, what? Wait a minute. That's not true. And then I have to clean it up. So this is a lifelong practice. But we develop an increasing trust. And we also develop a trust that the Dharma is pulling us towards very is giving us the gifts which the world most deeply needs. And if you look at the state of the world, we are in a new time in human history, because for the first time in human history, each and every one of the world's crises is human caused. And that means that the state of the world is an expression of of our individual and collective states of mind. The state of the world is the mirror of our collective minds. And what that means is, yes, we need to feed the hungry and house the homeless and work to reduce nuclear stockpiles and try to stop polluting our planet. And it also means that the deepest way of addressing those issues is to simultaneously attempt to heal the fundamental mistaken beliefs and values that underlie this. So our very Dharma work turns out to be what the world really most deeply needs at this time. Okay, I think we covered all those. We're actually a little over time. Maybe we'll take just a couple of minutes if anyone wants to comment or question, and then we'll bring it to close. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I'm deeply grateful to know that, because this was a first time experiment. So thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
Liz?
Yeah, that was really great. I was thinking, how the heck is all that together? And God, I felt nervous for you, but you did it. And you said so many things. I had a hard time sitting in my seat because I felt like hopping up and saying, yes, yes, you know, because it just resonated for me in so many different ways, especially what you just said, too, about our own intuition, which I like to call my IGS, my inner guidance system. Mm-hmm. And I have noticed with the work, and particularly the work in meditation and particularly the work in coming in silent retreats, is how much dust I can get off that guidance system and how helpful it is. It's really, really incredible. But I did just want to share one thing that was like a big aha for me this week, which you actually just talked about, which was this low frequency thought, feeling that I have that something is wrong with me.
Yes.
And that, I kind of knew this on an intellectual level and have been working on it. But, of course, the silence for me always brings a new clarity, and I'm able to see. And I really saw it, and I saw how it permeates so much of my thinking, and then my feeling, and then my actions. And, things that drive me or motivate me to want to feel better than, or less than, or victim, or hero, or, all different things. And so that was just, the realization of that for me is so freaking freeing to know. Yes. That I can't say that I feel like nothing's wrong with me now. I mean, I still feel like something's wrong with me, but the difference is that I see that and I know that thought's not real.
Beautiful.
And I don't know if that thought will ever go away, but I know that thought's not real. And what you
Beautiful.
Just said solidified that, insight, I guess, for me. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much for sharing that, because you point to something which is really valuable for all of us to know. And that is that the ego is founded, the egoic belief system is founded on a sense of deficiency and flaw. And I call this the fundamental flaw fallacy, that at some level we as ego assume there's something wrong with us. And there's actually a wisdom to that, because at one level there is, because that's not our true identity. So it's actually a very profound intuition, but it gets translated, because we identify with that, as, oh, there's something really wrong with me, all me, instead of with the little identity which we construct. So your recognition is a very important one and very, very foundational. And thank you for bringing up. It's a a gift to us all. So I want to say my thank yous. I have to say, you know, some of my best sittings happen when I'm just sitting up here. It's like I see you all sitting there, looking Buddha-like. It's like, okay, I should be present. So it's you know, in the Buddhist tradition, there's equal merit in both giving and receiving a Dhamma teaching, and such a priceless gift to have the opportunity of sitting with you and having, you know, practicing together, and then to have the priceless gift of being able to have an outlet for some of the insights and ideas and so forth that have arisen over the years through this practice. And it's just a gift to me and to us all. So I want to say my deep thanks, and I'd like to just suggest we just take a moment to once again appreciate our extraordinary good fortune, our free and well-favored lives, and the extraordinary priceless gift we have of having a teacher like Surya. I mean, I haven't heard such a sustained level of absolute teachings as he's put out in these advanced retreats, you know, anywhere. I mean, this is really rare what he does here. It's really rare, and it's an extraordinary gift. And so gratitude for him, gratitude for all those who worked so hard to make this retreat possible, gratitude to all of you for all your practice and good work, and gratitude for the Dzogchen Foundation, and may this inspire us to support their work even further. And gratitude, just gratitude. And out of that gratitude, we can notice that joy desires to be shared. Joy naturally wants to share itself. So just may we notice that we want to share our good fortune, and may we continue to practice, and may we become ever more effective instruments of help and healing and service.